Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. Previously, he directed the Conflict Prevention and Peacebuilding Initiative at the American University's Center for Global Peace, taught at New York University's Graduate School of Politics, and worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He's the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy, and U.S. Intervention, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And when you say, as your article's titled in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again, it does make one wonder whether or not Sudan's president, General Omar al-Bashir, is something of a kind of serial killer. We've seen so much bloodshed in Sudan. We've had a civil war between the north and the south that went on from 1983 to 2005, and that was settled. But since then, he has attacked South Sudan. He's driven out the Dinka, making 100,000 of them homeless. He's attacked civilians in North Kordofan, in the Blue Nile State, and in the Nuba Mountains, killing thousands. I spoke recently with a representative from Amnesty International, Donatella Rivera, who was there witnessing the atrocities in the Nuba Mountains, where under bombing. And it looks like it could actually, the war between the North and South could reignite at any moment. So am I right in assuming that this guy's a serial killer?
He is a serial killer. He's a lot like Slobodan Milosevic. In fact, Richard Holbrooke, with whom I used to work at the State Department, said about Milosevic that he would solve a problem by creating a bigger one. That's just what Bashir is doing. He had a serious case of buyer's remorse after agreeing to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005 that set South Sudan on the course towards independence. And his recent spasm of violence has been nothing more than an effort to undermine the new state and to try to reestablish Sudan's control, not only over tribes on its own territory, but oil reserves in South Sudan.
So my understanding is, David Phillips, again, the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention, and an article in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. So it's not just that Omar Bashir is a serial killer and he's the only head of state indicted by the International Criminal Court. He's also uses, it seems to me that he's a sort of thug hiding behind Islam, and he uses these constant wars as a way to justify his own control of his own people. And he's not particularly popular, from my understanding, but because of essentially martial law conditions, he keeps cracking down on any opposition in the name of being traitors against foreign enemies.
He's been immune from the Arab Spring. Any efforts to organize around the University of Khartoum have been very harshly repressed. The SPLM North, which represents the largest and most coherent opposition movement, has suffered a kind of Kristallnacht where their offices have been ransacked, their leaders arrested. Bashir has systematically undermined his opposition in order to stay in power and preserve what he has left in Sudan.
So how do you deal with this international pariah then? The fact that he's indicted by the International Criminal Court is one thing, but, you know, is he ever going to be extradited? I mean, there isn't a mechanism. It's worth noting, too, that the United States is not a participant in the International Criminal Court as well. So is there any realistic expectation that anything can be done?
And Bashir is deeply entrenched in power. and he's able to travel freely around Africa. Countries in the African Union don't arrest him and send him to The Hague. Sudan is also a member of the Organization of Islamic Conference, and Bashir travels freely to the OIC member states. So until these regional groupings recognize that he's a pariah in their midst, there's really very little pressure that can be brought to bear by Western countries. It also should be mentioned that China continues to run interference for Bashir and Sudan in the Security Council. So particularly after Libya, any kind of robust measures that Western countries want to take that could even remotely suggest a strategy of regime change are vetoed and obstructed by China and by Russia. So there's not a lot of room for diplomatic maneuver. There isn't a security solution. The solution has to come from within Sudan and from countries in the region. There are seven states that border Sudan. This instability has a hugely negative effect, not only in Sudan, but on all of the frontline states. So they have an interest in ratcheting up the pressure on Bashir as well.
But David Phillips, my understanding is that the Saudis have always had close relations, and they're supposedly our friends. What's the role of Saudi Arabia?
They probably have oil interests with the Sudanese State Oil Corporation. But this isn't really a matter that's going to be addressed by the Gulf States or the Gulf Cooperation Council. This is something that the solution lies with the people of Sudan. And it's important that they organize themselves, that there be an Arab Spring, that we find ways of supporting it, and that the frontline states that have always had their proxies in Sudan's fight stop meddling in the country's internal affairs, giving the Sudanese people the room and the space to resolve these problems on their own.
But what can be done to isolate Omar Bashir amongst the African leaders who accept him and the Islamic states who still accept him?
Well, this is the conundrum. If there was an easy solution to that, then the AU and the OIC would be working on it. You're right, Bashir has been very clever by somehow portraying this as a Western cabal or a Western strategy to try to assume ownership of Sudan's oil. There's really been no leadership coming from the AU or the OIC. Even the AU mediator, Thabo Mbeki, seems to be more interested in placating Khartoum than in achieving a durable solution. This agreement between South Sudan and Sudan, you know, it represents progress. You know, it is a step forward. But it has to be implemented, it has to be monitored, and the U.S. and other countries have to find ways of keeping the pressure on so that things don't start to backslide.
But I'm surprised that African leaders and Mbeki would be sympathetic to Bashir, because his whole career is about killing black Africans, Christian black Africans. There's been a racist component to this civil war from the beginning. It's been the Arab North against the animist and Christian South, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly the case. But there's also an African solidarity in the fight against colonialism, and Bashir has cleverly played on that.
So the fact that he's made a career out of killing black Africans in a racist for racist motivations, and they're still killing people in Darfur, and we've seen what the Janjaweed militia do, and it does seem to be entirely both a combination of race and religion. You'd think that would get some people's attention in Africa.
It should be noted that the AU has taken the lead in deploying a peacekeeping force, that there are thousands of troops from African countries that are on the ground in Darfur. But despite all these efforts and the enormous amount of money that's been spent on humanitarian relief over the years, you've seen over the past 6 months a resumption of violence in Darfur, where the IDP camps are being targeted. There are 500,000 people that have been displaced by violence in eastern Sudan as Bashir has turned his armed forces loose on some of the areas there in North Kordofan and Blue Nile and the Nuba Mountains. So there is leadership coming from the AU. They don't have the capacity to enforce agreements. This Addis Accord from September 27th represents a step forward, but unless you follow it up with diplomacy and you have a really robust and proactive monitoring mechanism that's put in place, you're going to see that agreement start to unravel, and you could very well see a resumption of the kind of civil war between Sudan and South Sudan in which 2 million people lost their lives.
So would we even know about this but for the efforts of people like George Clooney? I mean, it seems to me that not only are the African leaders somehow not stepping up or compromised, and Mbeki seems to be prone to that kind of thing. Then you've got the Islamic leaders basically accepting this guy as one of their own. And as far as I can tell, the only kind of pressure has come from people like George Clooney and other activists in Darfur in particular, pointing out what this guy's up to. But what's your sense about how serious Washington is, or have they come to the same conclusion that there's not a lot you can do?
Well, let me comment on the role of activists and the work that George Clooney has done in the past. I brought him and Elie Wiesel give a briefing to the UN Security Council on Darfur some years ago. And I have to tell you, Ian, it was probably the biggest day in the history of the UN. Every staff member, all the member states had people who showed up because they wanted to hear what George Clooney had to say about Darfur. So we shouldn't underestimate the importance of civil advocacy. What the Save Darfur Coalition did, spotlighting the genocide in Darfur, really mobilized all kinds of awareness and international pressure. So, you know, that's very important. How that translates into policy is the challenge that every advocacy organization faces. And the fact of the matter is the Obama administration, particularly during the run-up to the presidential election, hasn't wanted to create a conflict in Sudan. It already has its hands full with tribalism in Libya and the civil war in Syria. So it's been more than content to work discreetly and behind the scenes to try to support the AU to broker this agreement between Sudan and South Sudan. What we're going to see soon after the election is that unless that agreement is implemented, conditions are going to go bad to worse. And unless you stop a conflict in the early stages, it's going to worsen, and it'll cost more diplomatically and materially to deal with the crisis at the back end.
Well, I have to thank you very much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. Previously, he directed the Conflict Prevention and Peacebuilding Initiative at American University's Center for Global Peace, taught at New York University's Graduate School of Politics, and worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He is the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention, and he has an article in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night in America.
Took the kids to the park and disappeared.